Good afternoon. Welcome to the Penn World Voices Festival. My name is Roxana Robinson. I'm an officer on the board of Penn, and I want to welcome you on Penn's behalf. But I'm also appearing here in the capacity of your stand-up critic. This week, the National Book Critics Circle has designated six people, critics, to attend every event. And I'm going to give you five books that I recommend that you go out and buy this afternoon and read tonight. So the first, and these are a contemporary novel, a translated book, a classic, a small press independent, and a surprise. The first one is, the contemporary novel is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. It's one of the best contemporary novels I know. Its brilliant, shimmering surface, its astonishing velocity, its imaginative construction are impressive. But what's really breathtaking about this book is the confidence with which Egan moves through time, generations, and the music business. When we're finished with this, it feels as though we've read Proust, compressed. The translation is Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert, translated by Lydia Davis. This is a great book, translated by a great writer. How good can it get? Flaubert's mesmerizing narrative about the flawed, gorgeous Emma continues to confound us. We fall under her spell from our first glimpse of her, the shadows cast on her face by silk and rain. Throughout the book, Flaubert wrestles with his own ambivalence about her. And who are we to disagree with his ambivalence? The next is Anna Karenina. This is the classic by Leo Tolstoy, translated by Pavir and Volkonsky. One of the foundation stones of European literature. The narrative is formed by two great arcs, that of Levin, slowly rising, and that of Anna, making her doomed descent. Tolstoy's attentiveness to character and ideas and his deep meditative love of his world inform this novel and sweep you into it. Once you have read Anna Karenina, it will never leave you. The fourth, the small press book, is called Widow by Michel Latulippe. This is an elegant book of stories, precise and glittering like jewels. Latulippe writes exquisite Mandarin prose in sentences that you want to memorize. The stories are about excruciating loss and other things, being alive and having sex and being betrayed and having fun, and they will stay with you. The fifth book, The Surprise, is Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. This choice is made in recognition of the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War and of the author, who was my great-great-great-aunt. Great Aunt Hattie was a woman of moral conviction, and this book may not be a work of great literature, but it's a work of great courage. And it was written at a time when her ideas and thoughts were considered unacceptable. I'm proud to be a writer from her family. So that's my list. Go out and buy them. And now I will introduce you to Jakob Orsos, who is the director of the festival. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jakob Orsos. This is my honor to welcome you at the very end of the 7th annual Penn World Voices Festival. It's been a substantial, beautiful week with lots of good work. And my pleasure to be here tonight with all of you, and my pleasure to have Wole Soyinka with us delivering the Arthur Miller Freedom to Write lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let me introduce you first, before bringing Wole on stage, introduce you Steven Eisenberg, Executive Director of Pan American Center. Steve.
The opening ceremony of the 48th Penn International Congress was held here at the New York Public Library in 1986. That year, the president of Penn American Center, was Norman Mailer. Susan Sontag and Grace Paley, Sal Bellow and Gunter Grass were there. And Salman Rushdie, who reminisced about it all so well the other day, recalling the lively frictions of the time, called himself then the young guy in the corner. Arthur Miller, America's signature playwright, was there. That year, 1986, Wole Soyinka, who also attended the Congress, won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Now, 26 years on, the catalog of distinguished writers who served as Pen American Center presidents has grown up to this day with Anthony Appiah. Salman is in his seventh year as the chair of our World Voices Festival, which he founded and for which he has been its guiding spirit. The festival ends tonight with the Arthur Miller Lecture. What better place to mark our many partnerships and connections with the New York Public Library, which now celebrates its centennial year? What better place to summon the celebration and promotion of literature, the central identity and calling of Penn, and the New York Public Library? What better place to stamp on all our minds Penn's continuous devotion to protecting free expression everywhere, and to affirm Penn's place in the front lines of that fight? And how fitting it is to have Wole Soyinka speak under the auspices of the Arthur Miller Freedom to Write Lecture, as have his distinguished predecessors in that role, Orhan Pamuk, David Grossman, Umberto Eco, Nawal El-Sadawi, and Christopher Hitchens. As Penn enters its 90th year, the ties that bind us from 1986 until today and unto the future are the same. Freedom of expression, the precious place of literature in our public and private lives, and the international bridge that connects our mission. Why not then summon Arthur Miller's words to remind us of just why Penn exists? And as an introduction to Wole Soyinka, who has flown here from Nigeria and to whom we owe great thanks. Miller, then. So I imagine that Penn's originators believed that what was required, if mankind was not to destroy itself, was an organized reminder that humanity's survival transcended any nation's political interest, and that the most convincing example, if not proof, of humanity's essential oneness was the universality of the best literature. That Penn is still around after three quarters of a century, when it has no army, no navy, or air force, no political rewards or threats of punishment, is possibly a triumph of illusion over reality. The illusion that hope is rational in this world. There are still a lot of writers getting shot at, being jailed and tortured, people for whom the act of communication is very dangerous. Until then, with all its flounderings and failings and mistaken acts, it is still, I think, a fellowship moved by the hope that one day the work it tries and often manages to do will no longer be necessary. And now our friend and our colleague, Paul Holden Graber.
I just very, very briefly wanted to welcome you all to the New York Public Library. My name indeed is Paul Holden Graber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. As you know, my mission here is simply to make the lions roar to make a heavy institution dance, when successful, to make it levitate. It is really a great pleasure to be hosting, being co-hosting this public event with Penn on the last day of their seventh annual Arthur Miller Lecture, and to be having three events here today. It's a great pleasure to welcome to being the director of the Penn World Voices, Jakob Orsos, to be working with Steve Eisenberg, to be reminiscing about Arthur Miller here, to be remembering also that Norman Mailer took the stage here about 3 years ago with Günter Grass for the last time in his life, and to be having Voile Soyinka here, who I last time saw in such a different setting, I must say. Last time I saw Voile Soyinka was in Jamaica. We were on the beaches of Calabash, and there were about 1,500 people on the beach, and every 2 or 3 seconds they would say, "Yeah, man. Yeah, man," to whatever we were saying. And it was just a fantastic incantation. It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful moment. And I just hope that the Calabash Literary Festival continues. And I welcome all of you today, and I hope that you will come next week when we will have Ralph Nader interviewing Ted Turner and Peter Lewis, talking to them about why billionaires should give back their billions. I will be speaking also to Liz Gilbert, and the following week we will have Chris Blackwell, the founder of Atlantic Records, also from Jamaica, speaking about 50 years of Atlantic Island Records. And a week later we will be doing our final event, celebrating the 100 years, so together we are 190 years old, the 100 years of the New York Public Library, of this building at the New York Public Library, with an event with the Moss, a wonderful storytelling group. And the president of the library, who's retiring soon, Paul Leclerc, will be speaking. The event is called Reading Between the Lions. So I hope you will come on the 21st of May. Now, we have asked our guests in the last few months to submit us a bio in 7 words. And Voile Soyinka abided and gave us 7 words, which I don't exactly know what they mean. And maybe as he takes center stage, he will tell us. A disciple of Ogun with crucial deviations. Voile Soyinka.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, quick explication of that exercise in Précy. Ogun is a god of Yoruba god of creativity, of the lyric, as well as of war, of conflict. And it so happened, I was wrong, by the way, when you talked about the 7-word bio, I had in mind the previous request for a 50-word bio. So I had to make that up immediately. But it came very easily for the simple reason that I'd be talking about mythology tonight, and Ogun is one of the principal, one of the greatest myths in Yoruba pantheon and cosmology, and I happen to be a disciple of Ogun. So that's it, a disciple of Ogun, but with crucial deviations. Never wholeheartedly embraced mentors. Now, Humpty Dumpty, yet on the wall. It's sound audience relations always to begin on a sad note and then move on to euphoric cadences. So, firstly, tragedy. I am, as many of you are aware, a compulsive mythologist, and nothing would have been more fulfilling than to stand here today and affirm a frankly delightful piece of mythology. It concerns the ancestor in whose name we are all gathered here today, and my own self, that ancestor being, of course, Arthur Miller. It has not been easy to bring myself to debunk that mythology, especially as it links me also to one of the greatest works of pulchritude that the cinema has ever celebrated, that being Marilyn Monroe, whom I never met in real life. Like any former prisoner, I remain deeply appreciative of the efforts of the literary world, human rights organizations such as Amnesty International, etc., to obtain my liberty from the Nigerian military government during the Biafran War of Secession, 1966 to 69. Those who doubt that these efforts are of immense value to the physical and moral welfare of the prisoner, even if they do not immediately lead to his or her release, should take the testaments of the prisoners themselves and of their immediate colleagues and relations a little more seriously. I could not receive any indication of these efforts through normal channels while incarcerated, but as with most prisons, news have a way of percolating even the stoutest walls. I was aware that the world of letters had not forgotten my existence, and it mattered. Arthur Miller was at the forefront of agitators on my behalf, and I was able to thank him in person when we eventually met. However, and here comes the moment of deflation, I'm afraid my release had nothing to do with his being then married to Marilyn Monroe. Since this anecdote kept cropping up, it still does, I became curious and checked the truth of it from impeccable sources, including from the man who signed both my detention and release orders. I'm afraid Marilyn Monroe had nothing to do with it. Now, if instead of signing petitions and writing letters, Arthur Miller had dispatched Marilyn Monroe as his personal ambassador, I'm convinced that I would have been released much earlier. Since the pen is mightier than the sword, and beauty proved mightier than the pen, beauty would have shattered the general's swords in no time. I wish that were also true. From that sad note, albeit with the uplifting tonalities of the pursuit of beauty in the creative enterprise, and we're not speaking here, of course, of physical beauty alone, we shall shift temporarily away from the mythological realm to the factual. But we shall be back. Factual does not, of course, equate indisputable. So let who will dispute the following claim, for which this platform, PEN International, is singularly appropriate and deserving. And so, to make up for the deprivation of the myth of the connubial weapon in the liberation of one writer, that very writer now lays personal claim to the liberation of entire peoples from dictatorship. A veritable tsunami that began in the Maghreb has swept through North Africa to the Middle East, and is presently congealing, alas, as I write this, in the stubborn, blood-stained redoubts of Yemen, Libya, and Syria, among other slave plantations. I concede an enabling role to PEN International in this human transformation, but I insist on the lion's share for myself. The eruption of the contagious virus of change is deemed a revolutionary outbreak by some, others call it popular uprising, and others any number of names, the sum of which is known and understood by all as simply freedom. Mind you, even freedom has a rich and varied menu, none without its rationalizations. There is freedom to accept domination, freedom to accept power's control over individual choice, will, including even the exercise of thought. Some scriptures actually propose that freedom can only be found in the act of submission. Reams of theological tracts have been devoted to that thesis, sermonized from pulpits and every form of religious podium. There's freedom to listen also to the mockery of one's voice, bouncing back in diminishing echoes from walls controlled by the eyeless servitors of power. There's freedom to walk within the perimeter of walls rather than on the outside. Freedom even to meditate on the nature of walls, especially of the kind festooned with barbed wires, watchtowers bristling with guns, the circuit lined with anti-personnel mines patrolled by Alsatians and invisible electronic gadgets, the many clones of the Berlin Wall. There's freedom to kowtow to power, freedom to project freedom onto walls of enclosure, but never actually breach such walls into other kinds of freedom. There's also the freedom of exile, which for some is no freedom at all, but a crippling form of constraint. Some writers have found freedom in collaboration with power. Others, however, experience freedom in the very impulse that makes them get on their broomsticks, levitate and charge, hopefully knock Humpty Dumpty off his gilded perch with all the attendant risks. As an anguished ruler once protested, "What sort of freedom are these peasants talking about? Aren't they free to breed like rabbits within my domain?" I see that I have already invoked one of my favorite accessories for delineating the writer's occupation, the broomstick, which of course is a property of witchery or sorcery, necromancy. I shall try and justify that co-option as we proceed, but first, we must proceed to the grounds of my statement of claim in the stakes of the recent tidal wave of liberation. In December last year, I fulfilled an invitation to deliver a lecture to the African Development Bank in Tunis, where the world media has testified it all began. Do take careful note as I proceed of the interlinkage of the dramatis personae of individual and institutional as well as mythological players as we pursue the unfolding of history, propelled, aided, and abetted, as I said, by mythology, the classic kind this time. That bank, the ADB, has had quite a turbulent career. Its actual headquarters are in Abidjan, Ivory Coast, which some may recall, have been prominent on the world's radar of civil disturbances much further back than the most recent 2010-2011 edition might suggest. As a result of the earlier civil war that functionally split the nation in two, yes, over the very issue of electoral disenfranchisement 7 years ago, numerous businesses and institutions wisely relocated to safety, the African Development Bank among them. A week or two before my departure for Tunis in December, I received a note from the Writers in Prison Committee of International Pen requesting that I use the occasion of my presence in that country to address the situation of literary life and of some imperiled Tunisian writers. Here's an excerpt from that address. It's a bit longish, but of course, it is not only pertinent to this occasion, but it also affords me the chance to report back to Penn that I did faithfully carry out my assignment. In Yoruba, we say, "Eni ronin shela beru, akin beru en tama jefun." That means it's he who sent, the person who sends us on an errand, whom we obey, not the person to whom we deliver it. So, here goes. I said, "I perceive no difference between secular conduct and instances of religious intolerance that move to fundamentalist cleansing of society, such as resulted in the near martyrdom of our late colleague Naguib Mahfouz, nearly prematurely cut down, a victim of brainwashed youth, indoctrinated by the powerful voices of bigotry, intolerance, and ignorance. I need not remind us of those extreme instances of what reigned next door in Algeria, where, as I once lamented, writers, poets, intellectuals, dramatists, musicians, cineasts, and journalists sometimes felt obliged to write their last will and testament before setting off to earn a day's living, as they never knew what they may have written or spoken that set the terminal censors on their trail marked down for elimination. If writers and intellectuals have a duty to humanity, it is to insist that the human entity remains the primary asset in overall development, thus it must be safeguarded. In Africa today, can we even claim that within this modest delineation of his functions, the intellectual or writer is even guaranteed survival? I recall the fate of the writer Tahar Jaout and his work, The Last Season of Unreason, which was posthumously published. Unlike Naguib Mahfouz, he did not escape the calling card of the dogmatic in The Assassin. Were these merely exceptions to the rule, or are we dealing with an enduring anti-intellectual phenomenon? Was Jaout simply an extreme instance of the fate of the writer and intellectual in a singularly atavistic zone of bigotry, of the hatred of independent thought, the lure of conformity that power, even of the informal kind, requires in order to make itself manifest? There's no difference whatsoever between the hermetic cast of mind that eliminates such human asset in the name of religion and its secular counterparts that guarantee the end of the Ben Kadadwas of Uganda, drive out writers and scholars like Tasmir Nian of Guinea-Conakry, the poet and critic Chenjerai Hove of Zimbabwe, etc., into prolonged exile. Writers and intellectuals also form associations, local and international, both to cater for the welfare of their members as well as contribute to human productivity wherever they are situated. So one must ask why an organization like PEN International is classified as an illegal organization in a supposedly enlightened nation like Tunisia, with some of its members subjected to routine harassment. Among them, let me single out in the immediate Taufik Ben Brik and Fakim Boukadous, currently serving prison sentences, Mouldi Zouabi on trial on suspiciously politically motivated charges. To what end are such minds excluded from national productivity? To whose tedious constructs of security needs are they sacrificed? There is a sad echo across the continent, north to south and east to west, an echo that narrates the deterioration of once admired liberation fighters and leaders, such as Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, into fascistic monsters, obsessed with self-perpetuation, locked in a vision of an ultimate state burial, even if the nation over which they preside are themselves buried in the rubble of insensate power. Well, a familiar protest on behalf of our literary tribe, full of sound and fury and perhaps signifying little. But what do you think happened the moment when I uttered the name Taufik Ben Brik and Fakim Boukadous? There was an instant blackout. Understand this, Tunisia is not Nigeria. The levels of infrastructural development in both are so wide apart that I always find it an abuse of categorization to refer to both as developing or underdeveloped countries. Blackouts, I would later affirm, had not been experienced within living memories of most of my audience. Bearing the burden of my nation's culture of infrastructural decay, however, I actually felt compelled to apologize to the audience for having brought about the contamination of Tunisia with my nation's electroleptic fits. Well, we waited for about 10, 15 minutes, confident that the blackout would be brief. Fortunately, it was not too large a hall, just about this size, so I tested it for acoustics with my iron lungs. When the audience on the back row assured me that I was audible, I resumed, only to be stopped by the officials. They apologized but pointed out that the event was being simulcast to various stations on the continent where the ADB had branches. Thus, we had no choice but to wait. It took a while, but power was eventually restored. Now, I have to admit that most unusually, my mind did not embark on any conspiracy theory. Just one of those things, and I dismissed the incident. However, at a reception the following day, two senior ADB officials pulled me aside and urged me to be somewhat circumspect with my movement for the rest of my stay. Indeed, I was assigned a minder just to be on the safe side. My hosts had been quietly informed by their Tunisian counterparts of displeasure within the system at my comments, and revealed that the blackout was no accident. It would appear that the moment that I embarked on a condemnation of the government's act of placing pen under interdiction, the ever-present listening ears pricked up and signals went out. By the time I launched into the names of the first two Tunisian dissident writers, the response was automatic, well-oiled, and efficient. Power was instantly cut, and the microphones silenced. Beneath the liberal placidity of Tunisian society, I would encounter other indications of a police state furtive to blatant manifestations of totalitarian infiltration of public and even private events. Yes, power was cut off, but now power has also been snuffed out. As we say in Nigeria, power pass power. Now, if you think I'm simply making extravagant claims for a purely fortuitous act of timing, let me remind you that I come from a culture where names have meaning, and some of these either denote or evoke unseen mythological powers. Thus, where there's a supernatural connotation to a name, let all infidels beware. That name, Soyinka, given its full version, is Oshoyimika, which means I'm surrounded by sorcerers, witches, necromancers, all in the same family. Next, the Nigerian deity, Shango, is the god of lightning and thunder, whose earthly emanations are invested in the domain of fire. As the deity of lightning today, Shango has metamorphosed in a technological world into the god of electricity. Visit Lagos, Nigeria, and you will encounter a huge statue, modern statue of Shango, outside the marine headquarters of the Electricity Corporation, much to the distress of that deity, I'm sure, since that corporation is easily the most unproductive public service utility in the entire land. Indeed, it's a wonder that an angry Shango has not blasted that structure with a direct lightning hit for associating his image with such a damp squib. Well, maybe it's its very soggy constitution that protects it from divine incineration. However, back to Tunisia. By disrespecting Shango, god of electricity, the Tunisian powers angered the true powers that be, who watched, waited, then proceeded to show them the full range of transcendental power. There once lived a colorful personality in this part of the world, a preacher named Father Divine, whose calling was not too distant from ours, since his material was rhetoric. He was sentenced to a long term of imprisonment in what most of his followers insisted was a politically motivated miscarriage of justice. As he left the dock, he turned to the judge and said something to the effect of, "You wait and see what will shortly happen to you." A few days later, the judge was dead. Father Divine was woken up in prison and asked for his reaction. Apparently not missing a beat, he replied, "I hated to do it." Like Father Divine, writers sound such warnings constantly, but they never claim responsibility when the inevitable happens. I think it's about time that modesty was abandoned. The guardian sorcerers who surround us take silent note. They pass this message to the presiding deity, in my case, Shango, a turbulent deity whose province is also the administration of retributive justice. And he did the rest. Let's not forget also the immediate human trigger of the Tunisian Revolution. Shango's self-sacrificing agent who set himself on fire. His medium of protest was no accident, and I hope he recovers fully so I can visit, commiserate, then celebrate with him. I shall console him, reassure him that he had been possessed by Shango. He incinerated the status quo, even at the price of letting fire consume his body. Unless, of course, that individual was indeed Shango in his own person. Why not? Yoruba deities, as in many of the world's mythologies, are, of course, figures of ambiguity, contradictions, never straightforwardly black and white. Cruelty is as much part of their game as is benevolence, or lyricism, justice, and numerous other virtues. But then, think of all Christian martyrs and or heretics who went the way of the auto da fe in defense of a conviction or simply engaged in the mission that their faith be purged of all impurities. We could go on and on in that direction, and we'd only arrive at a conclusion that it is sad, truly sad, that at this stage of human development, such a high price has to be paid again and again on behalf of such a basic commodity that is in the intangible bequest of humanity. The freedom to think, freedom to move thought into expression, that is, to communicate. Otherwise, what use is thought? Freedom to explore, interrogate, and critique the boundaries of seeming reality. Yes, that false reality that endures in so many nations, in some cases for upwards of half a century, a century, only to collapse at the first or next or succession of pinpricks administered by the creative temperament that refuses to be circumscribed or constricted. Those whose very craft equates the eternal cry of humanity, freedom. I think of them sometimes as the intuitive heretics of orthodoxy, secular or religious. They are the witches, the sorcerers of the apparent, necromancers transcending the limitations of reality or appearance. Let me not bore you here with allied witchcraft theories, victories over some of these other pretenders to reality. Egypt, Ivory Coast, Libya. Well, maybe one more. Just a quick word on Libya, in case some of you skeptics believe that Tunisia was just a fluke. Again, just in December last year, a number of us, not just writers, were honored with the rather impressive title of Africa Excellence Award. Among them, there was Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Wolfenson, former president of the World Bank, Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa, Ismail Seragheldin, Director General of that bastion of knowledge, the Library of Alexandria, and others. Ismail Seragheldin, guardian of the word in that Library of Alexandria, many people do not know this, is also a writer and a Shakespearean critic. He has also delivered measured but uncompromising lectures in defense of the freedom of expression in the Arab world. About a year ago, he was menaced by religious zealots for calling for an end to clerical interference and censorship in matters of science and culture. Altogether, a most congenial human environment in which to submit to the rituals of honor and the delights of Ghana, herself no stranger to the trauma of prolonged military dictatorship. Alas, there was, grouped among us, one unbelievable incongruity. A certain Mohammed Gaddafi. A belated discovery, which is just the kind of company quite a number of us on that list would rather avoid. And so we muttered imprecations from cross-cultural mythologies, deploying somewhat more formal language to convey our feelings to the administering foundation. Well, they engage in something between administrative and or diplomatic tactics, succeeded in keeping the dictator away from the occasion, but his medals, certificates, souvenirs, and robes of honor were taken to him in Tripoli, where he was formally invested by a delegation. If only Gaddafi had read his media. I do not mention anything about being wary of the Greeks when they come bearing gifts. That model would be far too mundane, too mechanistic. Anyone can hide soldiers in the belly of a wooden horse. The Medea protest against injustice was much closer to our powers of sorcery, even without recourse to her chilling, or more specifically, burning pharmacological expertise. If Gaddafi had known about the powers of sympathetic magic, he would never have allowed the delegation to put those graduation robes on him. They arrived impregnated by a near half-century potency of tyranny repudiation, brought to a head by the gathering of witches in Accra. We hated to do it. However, the continent had begun to speak. The ghosts of victims infiltrated into the seams of those robes had begun to corrode the empire that Libya's King Ubu so vaingloriously invested in his own person. Well, enough of gloating. We have to admit that the process of exorcism, of prizing these monsters off their pedestals, is agonizingly slow, indeed embarrassingly so. The Humpty Dumpties of the world have a self-replicating capability that boggles the mind, and unfortunately they feed off one another's anti-human determination. Perched on their local equivalents of the Berlin Wall, that seemingly eternal symbol of the human propensity for the enslavement of its own kind, especially in the name of dogma, each is convinced that he has found the secret that other fallen idols failed to unearth. When the crash of this ideological enclosure took with it quite an impressive roll call of monsters such as Nicholas Ceausescu, Enver Hoxha, Milosevic and company, a wind of euphoria swept through the world, but in the end, it appeared that no sooner was one buried under the walls of his own construction that had sealed in the local humanity and bottled up their voices than another hoisted up himself, preferably on a heap of bodies. It has to be this contagious tenacity that nerved neophytes like Laurent Gbagbo of Ivory Coast to engage in suicidal missions, lacking the courage to die alone, but rather Samson-like, pull down the nation edifice over their own heads, ensuring the deaths of thousands of innocents. Well, why not? Laurent Gbagbo looks out from his fortified observatory and sees Robert Mugabe still riding it out on his own wall, blotting out the horizon for others with his grossly inflated ego. These obscenities accuse us, alas, of sorcery deficiency, remedies for which we must continue to pursue in both tried and tested and completely innovative means. When the life of a Salman Rushdie or another literary tribesman is declared open season for all religious or secular psychopaths, we should, as I proposed at the time, organize an unmanned aerial armada of those contemporary broomsticks known as the hot air balloons, load the wicker baskets with the allegedly offending material, and using the latest witchcraft technology known as remote control, spew their contents all over Humpty Dumpty's wall. Sooner or later, true power will lend a hand. And at the next Witches' Coven of Penn International, we shall revisit our geography of the expanded witches' domain and see if the momentum that was begun on north of the continent has carried not only southwards to Sudan, the Congo, and Zimbabwe, but further eastward to places like Iran, where writers and other protagonists of their rights of the mind endure an existence of daily insecurity under one form of menace or another, where activists, male and female, old or young, are still secretly hanged in prisons. And state paranoia has all but stifled the freedom that attaches to all forms of creativity, turned the practitioners into furtive internal exiles in their own nations. I do not deny it. I remain attached to my view of the literary occupation, if only through its antiquity, as not too distant from that of witchcraft or sorcery. Ranged against this calling is Humpty Dumpty, derivative as much from the famous English nursery rhyme as from original illustrations of Alfred Jarry's Ubu Roa, that grossly inflated paunch surmounted by a pin-sized head that tapers into the conical hat of a dunce. Mind you, the Harry Potter witches are a different breed from the witches of Salem or Maya Beokuta, or as depicted by writers like Maurice Conde or Dio Fagnoa, the Yoruba novelist. All animate entities evolve, and these include witches and writers. The methods adjusted as much by environment as by the challenges of the moment. Today's witches ride motorcars and propel even antique models like rockets. It is quite possible that the very first witches, in fact, were writers, or vice versa, that writers evolved from witches. Just an idea. We know, however, that words are insubstantial, yet they can exercise the force of magic. Any celebration of the word, therefore, is indeed a homage to the power of transformation, which is how literature ends its very right of existence. A witch transforms a giant into a gnat, a monster into a mouse, a despot into a pisspot, evaporates castles by mere incantation, as does the writer by will and by word. If the word does not aim to transform, to alter the shape of reality before our very eyes, then it is usurping valuable space, even in the virtual realm. And then, as far back as we can rely on the oral narratives of societies, and of course, in documented history and literature, even right up to this moment, right, witches have always been considered a most disruptive variant of the human species. They peered into the human soul, pared away all subterfuge, and dared proclaim what they discerned within it. They have this strange faculty of foresight, the courage to probe into the future. Or they were believed to possess it, which came to the same thing, since it carried with it near identical consequences. In truth, they were simply no more than shrewd psychologists, endowed with abnormal patience, but their actual claims are not really important. What matters was what society believed them capable of, especially power. Even if in a curative exercise, the witch made use of the same herbs and potions that others prescribed for coughs, rheumatism, or epileptic fits, the fact that this came from an alleged witch imbued the same medications with supernatural powers in the opinion of society, and thus made the prescriber guilty of something that smacked of the abnormal and subversive. Accompanied by the word, in any form, material life took on an empowerment or enhancement of potency that it lacked on its own. The victims of America's infamous Salem witch hunt, dramatized so memorably in Arthur Miller's The Crucible, were only rehabilitated towards the end of the last century by President Clinton, 400 years after their torture and hanging. Much good may do them, but I believe it is right that society revisit these collective, infectious, and often terminal imbecilities, if only to remind ourselves of the unfinished business of the enthronement of tolerance, the right of dissent, openness to the unusual or mystifying, and the acknowledgement of human fallibility. In short, simply remind us that Humpty Dumpty or his Orwellian successor, Big Brother, is still seated on the wall. Sorcery and witchcraft thus serve us as more than mere metaphors. Didn't the Vatican issue, only a few years ago, a declaration denouncing the entire Harry Potter industry as a product of diabolism and abuse of impressionable minds, clerics of all faiths simply cannot bear the rupture of reality. Never mind that all faiths are founded on that very exercise of imaginative projection. Mind you, the position of the Vatican could be put down to mere professional jealousy. And I do not mean simply in the business of appropriating realms beyond the real. No, I'm talking now of material, you know, things. Speaking of comparative earning powers. Religious stocks have been falling of late. Imagine how much the Roman Catholic Church has had to shell out in compensation for sexual abuses of youth by its own priests. While Miss Rawlings, accused of the abuse of their minds, continues to rake in the millions. But who knows? Yeah, the Vatican would probably find support among us writers. No writer has a right to make that much money. Indeed, without diabolical assistance, no writer can. So when the firewood has been gathered and the auto da fe pronounced ready, watch me race to strike that match. But what, if we may depart from that region of envy, what, after all, is at stake? In truth, just the human voice. But what a primordial commodity this is. A compatriot and friend who never lets anything pass that he thinks might be of interest to me sent me a clipping from the New York Times only a few weeks ago, accompanying the linkage with the words, "I'm indeed ecstatic to send this to you." I downloaded the attachment, and there it was. The Origin of Language, the latest verdict on that subject, now declares, began on the continent of Africa. Now, clearly, we have a stake in the fortunes of that faculty. Here are some snippets. A researcher analyzing the sounds and languages spoken around the world has detected an ancient signal that points to southern Africa as the place where modern human language originated. Further on, we learn that some of the click using languages of Africa have more than 100 phonemes, whereas Hawaiian, towards the far end of the human migration route out of Africa, has only 13. English has about 45 phonemes. Fascinating, though the foregoing must be for those of us who could never attempt Miriam Makeba's click song. It is the observation of one Dr. Mark Pagel that twangs a secret combative spiral in my DNA. He declares, "Language is our secret weapon. And as soon as we got language, we became a really dangerous species." I have a feeling that, like me, most of us here are frankly not all that ecstatic, as my countrymen, about the possibility that the origin of language may indeed be traced to one's continent rather than another's. We are, or should be, far more exercised by who ultimately controls it, the Humpty Dumpties or the witches sorcerers. The ideal answer, of course, is that no one should. And this translates into not censorship, but watchfulness. This is where the real battle lies, and it is no trivial contest. It formed the subject of the Nobel acceptance speech of Harold Pinter in Stockholm, where he denounced the manipulation of words both in the context of the war in former Yugoslavia and, of course, in the infamous US-Iraqi war. Closer to us on the continent, now credited with the origin of human speech, we're drearily familiar with the horrors inflicted on language by one ruler or another ever since colonial times, and not only in the language of the indigens, but in the language of colonial imposition. This co-option, let us note, is done without the slightest embarrassment at forging an alliance with the very instruments of oppression, dispossession, and disdain, and for identical purposes, turned yet again against their own kind once under colonial subjugation. Let's not speak in the abstract. When opposition mounted in Zimbabwe some years ago, and the populace moved to push Humpty Dumpty off his wall, an opposition that became most intense among the sprawling makeshift urban settlements. Mugabe sent in his brown shirts, the ragtag veterans backed by bulldozers to wipe out the teeming overpopulated strongholds of opposition. Brown shirts, surely that analogy is carrying things too far, but wait a minute. The naming proves historically appropriate. Brown shirts in this instance, as a privilege of naming, is not even one of external appropriation, but reclamation. I cannot swear that language itself did or did not originate in Africa, but Africa it was that gave birth to the word brown shirt and its significations. A recent work, The Kaiser's Holocaust, subtitled Germany's Colonial Genocide and the African Roots of Nazism, documents that trajectory, a work that should serve to jog memories and serve warnings. Jog memories that have been occluded by the enormity of its actualization on German soil. The word originated in Namibia, where an early experiment in ethnic cleansing, another abuse of language, by German colonists, would later attain its horrendous denouement. The Hereros of Namibia were the early guinea pigs of the Germanic race purist delusions, and the brown shirt that is today associated with Adolf Hitler's hit squad and the rise of Nazi Germany was the uniform, khaki tropical shirts and shirts favored by the German colonists who masterminded Africa's colonial foretaste of the final solution. Even the Nazi concentration camps were originally conceived and practicalized on the continent, a project that aimed at nothing less than the extermination of the Herero as a people. Some of the initiators of the Herero massacres and race attrition, recalled or retired to Germany, were personally involved, they or their relations, in the planning and execution of Germany's internal scourge of race purification. Language, said the cited philologist, was our secret weapon. And as soon as we got language, we became a really dangerous species. How true? There is the baseline. That is why the conflict is unceasing. The primal struggle for that primal weapon, language, its uses, abuses, and control. Yes, language has more to it than the mere mechanics of ascription. Often it supplies the building blocks of a people's history, as much of it as ennobling as of the dispiriting kind. The veterans of Zimbabwe, Zimbabwean anti-colonial struggle, were heroes of liberation and self-sacrifice. Today, thanks to one individual, they can only be associated through power conversion with brown shirts. Africa sadly reclaims her linguistic history, but regrettably, not of the most edifying kind. Of course, factors quite external to language help, although there again we have to be careful in determining what truly constitutes language. What Peter Sellers in the film Dr. Strangelove, or How I Came to Stop Worrying and Love the Atom Bomb, for instance, no gesture is more eloquent, satirical, but grim, than whenever that comic actor attempts to control his arm from snapping up into a horizontal, familiar Nazi salute. Then cut to Mugabe, pumping the air in a passable imitation or, at his competitive ranting best, aided and abetted by that parsimonious but evocative smudge on his upper lip that tries to pass for the iconic Hitlerian moustache. But we shall forget the external aids and stick to the bare bones of the articulated word and not as prejudicially converted by the speaker. I began to refer to the unambiguous entry of the proletariat at the forefront of the Zimbabwean revolt. There was no further possibility of keeping up the rhetoric that it was only the white, racist, land-guzzling settlers that were active against this progressive defender of black African interests. But starkly, incontrovertibly, Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth. It was against these that Mugabe deployed his brown shirts and bulldozers. But was he flummoxed when confronted with evidence of this further dehumanization of the slum dwellers of Zimbabwe? No. Pat came the explanation. It was nothing more than a normal exercise in urban sanitation. Those words sent a chill down my spine, but it was a familiar chill. Had the world not been allowed to forget an earlier massacre in Matabeleland by that same Humpty Dumpty, a massacre that took place with the participation of mercenaries from North Korea and is reliably recorded to have claimed between 10,000 and 20,000 lives of humanity, of both genders, and from geriatrics to infants, often in the most sadistic manner. It is the word, the expression itself, when subverted to the service of such power-enabled bestialities, that proves especially traumatizing. The mind, especially of an African raised within a continent whose apartheid policies lasted most of its maturing years, does not require much instigation to wonder how the language of urban sanitation differed from the policy of apartheid South Africa, which wiped out black habitations to create a cordon sanitaire between black urban settlements and the ruling white minority of that society. The language of apartheid was near identical. Society must be cleansed of the designated dregs of society. In reality, the poor but articulate dissidents suddenly rendered homeless by the hundreds of thousands. All that was left, as they were herded in makeshift prisons, was that primordial possession, the voice. It is this voice that is picked up by the poets, the urban songsters, and their fellow beings, in proof of their human validation. Now, we're not speaking only of the celebrated literati of their communities, not of the testimonies of their cosmopolitan protagonists at Penn and other international gatherings. No, we are speaking of that primordial witches' coven whose members transfigure the world, the virtual world on which their spokesmen and women glide on broomsticks to lunge at Humpty Dumpty enthroned on his wall of deception, constriction, and domination. We're speaking of the denizens of that world who emerge from their degradation to speak in a language of their own, from whose inner community a number gather once in a while on occasions like this to compare notes, relishing, why not, the moments of a break from those zones of state-engendered urban sanitation, where humanity is not even allowed to stitch its rags and pluck out its fleas in peace, unless, of course, it first surrenders that primary possession, its transforming voice. It is the ploy of power and its acolytes to propose that such cosmopolitan voices are divorced from their origins, to propose that they are alienates who represent no one but themselves and their foreign toastmasters. The people, however, know the true source from which their language derives, and it is not the language of urban sanitation. We're speaking, for instance, if I may shift medium a little, of the inscriptions on the signs and mastheads of passenger lorries, taxis, and other forms of improvised public transport which trundle over the rot and potholes and filth-lined tracks called roads, hurling goods and human cargo from farm to market and from drudgery to bare survival. I sometimes call them mobile murals and call attention to them, not merely on occasions such as this, but at the gatherings of rulers in my own continent. Some of you who've been to Africa may have traveled in those vehicles. They carry pithy summaries of their inmates' expectations and warnings to power and privilege. Expressions of protest and wry laments inserted into the gulf that separate their idyllic vista from the reality they are compelled to endure. One in particular you may have encountered on the bookshelves, but without awareness of its origin. It goes, "The beautiful," spelled T-Y, "the beautiful ones are not yet born." That caption was appropriated with acknowledgement by Ai Kweyama, the Ghanaian novelist, for his novel that came out in the 60s, a scatological indictment of Ghana's corrupt reality at the time, a truthful elaboration of that saying, since Aikwe knew at first hand the terrain that had produced that shorthand of a pessimistic, lamentable actuality. Here's another from my Yoruba part of the world. It goes, Ewenla Koniruwewe. It means, "The falling leaf, however large, shall not crush the smaller." Watch the example of the big leaf, Mr. Big Man, says that painter-poet. When it detaches, it simply floats gently to the ground and settles over the smaller one, even protectively, not bruising it, not crush it, simply because it is bigger. Another, in broken English, chop small, quench small. Chop big, quench big. Which is obviously addressed to our Humpty Dumpties who eat up a nation's resources, indifferent to the consequences. Chop means eat. Eat small, die small. Quench means die. But eat big, die big. That shorthand rivals, for its prophetic succinctness, another which remains my all-time favorite, a caution that has yet to be taken to heart by the practiced survivors, so far, of the hurricane of change. It seems to be the favorite, also, of all the West African countries I've visited, and it goes, "No condition is permanent." Yes, we're speaking of those voices, of the frustrated and disenfranchised, whose street troubadours seize the opportunity of Barack Obama's ascendancy to power in the United States to launch a song that went, "It is easier for a Luo to become president of the United States than to be president of Uganda." The language of that song was plain enough for even the dumbest audiences, but the lesson was not taken to heart. Uganda underwent the most horrifying outbreak of urban violence, bordering on the very collapse of humanity. And yet, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, Muchere Mugo, and others had also warned in extended parables and direct polemics, giving voice to the season of discontent that had begun to stretch into an eternity. Arap Moi's prisons and detention laws had only built up behind them the tidal waves that eventually engulfed Uganda. The unheeded voices reverted to their primordiality, where articulation was no longer capable of modulation. Oh yes, indeed, there's always been a life and death contest for the appropriation of the human voice, a contest that takes many forms. The canonical text, for instance, secular and or divine, has proved perhaps the most deadly of these control ploys. The ultimate word, whose very raison d'etre demands that nothing is left for any other human to utter or think. In our technological age, this is accompanied by closure of alternative channels and even seizure of communication resources. The world's ideological behemoths, from Stalin to Pol Pot or the Chinese Gang of Four, etc., made it their life mission to stifle and extinguish such textual propositions as did not adhere to theirs. The Bible, the Quran, Fon Long manuals, Hindu or Buddhist texts, while those, some of those at least, in turn, did their best to repay the compliment wherever they were established. The Taliban, for instance, on overrunning Afghanistan, displayed one of the crassest instances of textual jealousy. But then they had precedent, for which one need not travel as far back in antiquity as the Roman Catholic Index. Apartheid South Africa, for instance, with her list of banned books, or Malawi's censorship list under Hastings Banda, etc., etc., all poor cousins of communism's internal and mutually destructive literary controls. Consider the amount of anti-literary energy that was expended over works, over which works of literature were ideologically correct or incorrect. The latter grouped summatively as reactionary, undialectic, products of false consciousness, etc., etc. Variations of these contests survive till today in many parts of the third world. Extreme disciples, of which still roam the jungles, the mountain fastnesses, or urban settlements of Nigeria, armed with definitive texts and other products of textology that explicate the history and destiny of mankind from birth to death and excommunicate all others. One such surfaced in Nigeria quite recently, calls itself Boko Haram, translated as death to all books. Except, of course, only one, theirs. Its quite a young career has already resulted in the extermination of hundreds, some of you may have read, and the rampage goes on till today. Only my book, none else. Muhammad Gaddafi could not wait to get in on the act. Many people believe that he remains simply obsessed with power and domination of the political kind, yes, unquestionably. But we tend to ignore the fact that he was also a writer. Oh yes, he did write. Remember the Green Book? That dead-on-arrival testament on which he spent the revenue from millions of barrels of oil to promote as a great rival to other super texts such as Chairman Mao's Red Book or the Communist Manifesto. That was the first primary and prophetic fall of that Humpty Dumpty. The attempt to turn a juvenile tract into an exegetical text for all ages with a lavishly funded international conference staged in this very country where the great guru graciously beamed his voice via satellite. It is good for us that dictators also insist on their own freedom to write. The world remains the most accommodating vehicle. The word remains the most accommodating vehicle for human communication. Hence, its centrality in the evolution of social man. Man did not develop language simply because he had the highest developed speech organs. That development commenced simply because man needed to communicate, an activity that takes place even without the physiological organs of speech. This by no means diminishes the power of the word itself, even on the inanimate or invisible. Examples, the famous Hittite-Luwian tablet exhumed quite recently, with writing that was addressed directly to the then rampaging plague, imploring it to leave town. Like the tablet, the traditional healer in my own society, for instance, let's say he had to treat a snake bite. He'd make an incision, rub the spot with some herbal extract, but then he'll proceed to bombard the venom in the bloodstream with incantations. What is he saying, in effect, but in far more lyrical, of course, evocative language is, hey, you villainous son of a snake, I know you are in there. Come out at once and leave this man in peace. In some Islamic usages, Quranic texts are made to serve a similar purpose. Only they are written, not orally delivered. Never mind that they end up being orally imbibed. The text goes on a slate, is washed into a bowl. Part of it is then rubbed on the patient's head, face, etc., while the rest is given to him to drink. Obviously, if the text did not matter, his patient would just have been treated with the swallow of the ink directly, without its transformation into written religious commands. No matter the culture, one finds that from time immemorial, communication has been developed to the highest levels of even the therapeutic arts. Communication with the world of the inanimate in an animistic world, or indeed among religions, which look down on the belief systems of the world of animism or ancestor worship, yet firmly acknowledge the existence of unseen forces, all these place all such societies on the same level of reverence for the potency of the word. They all acknowledge the existence of invisible forces with whom logically forms of communication must be devised, oral, written, or symbolic. Humanity, it is clear, has never been content to communicate only with his own immediate neighbor. We know that even prayers are not necessarily spoken. Prayer wheels and scrolls are a feature of a number of Asian religions, just as some prayers are painted onto kites and then released into the wind. With such undeniable universality, versatility, indeed transcendentalism in man's need to communicate with his kind and even with otherworldly species, is it really conceivable that the word can be left to the provenance of a minority, a self-appointed, power elitist, rapacious, unrepresentative, and often unconscionable minority? The attempt will always be made, somewhere, somehow, and persistently. And so the battle lines, or walls of contestation, remain drawn between Humpty Dumpty and the witches cum sorcerers of the world. Despite your watchtowers proclaim the latter, the word shall fly. And they shall win this battle, as they have won it again and again, despite losses, despite setbacks, despite a numbing sense of a Sisyphean curse, fighting the same battle over and over again. They are energized, however, because the very mobility of the masthead inscription on the conveyance that takes the witches to battle has summed it all up. Like claims for the origin of language itself, that inscription is native to the people of a continent that contested the arrogance of colonialism. It was transported into a Europe demarcated by the inhumanity of the Berlin Wall, returned to the southern part of the African continent in a renewed assault on the walls of apartheid, newly shimmers across the North African landscape, from where it has leapt, a fireball, into the Middle East. In short, continues to carry the battle to spaces of freedom-deprived humanity, spaces hitherto thought impregnable. And at base, nothing more mysterious than a simple, poetic, and prophetic inscription that reads, "No condition is permanent." Or, to try to be a little more original, not so mellifluous, but most suited to a culture of car stickers, Dump Dumpty. Thank you.